Welcome to the podcast series Interviews and Conversations presented by the Basler Afrika Bibliographien. Today's episode features a reading by the South African writer Louise Nkosi. Louise Nkosi, born in Embo, KwaZulu-Natal in 1936, was an acclaimed journalist, writer, and professor of literature in various African and European countries, as well as in the United States. Living in exile since 1960, he resided in Basel, Switzerland between 1997 and 2010. On the 11th of November 1999, he gave a reading from his yet unpublished novel, Mandela's Ego, at the Basler Afrika Bibliographien. In the following recording, he explains his motivation to write about the day Mandela is arrested, reads from his novel, and reflects about the challenges of also writing in his mother tongue, isiZulu.
I don't know whether many of you know the story of how Mandela was on the run, and he was described as the Black Pimpernel after the Red Pimpernel, and the story of how he was arrested always made me, I shouldn't say things like this. Yeah, it did make me laugh. Mandela used, those of you who have read the biography of Mandela will know the story of how he was arrested. But he used to drive around Johannesburg pretending to be a chauffeur for Cecil Williams, who was a member of the Communist Party, which was not such a good idea for men on the run to be mesmerized with the Communist Party. So Mandela tells the story of how once he was driving this car, and he stopped at the lights, and Spengler, whom I knew because we used to interrogate him, to ask him to give us statements for our newspaper. And Spengler was looking for Mandela, and it was going to be a great honor to apprehend Mandela. Yeah. So there was Mandela parking his car, and pretending to be a chauffeur, and there was Major Spengler parking next to him, and Nelson says he saw Spengler looking at him and thought, this is the end. Now he's got hold of me. Only to find that Major Spengler, did not recognize him, and he drove past. I tried to write a novel, which I'm working on at the moment. This is what I'm going to read for you before I read a passage or two from Maitenberg. The novel is about, I started it at the University of Brandeis, at Brandeis University, where I was teaching literature as well as writing. And I had these nice kids, and in order to inspire them to start writing, I said, okay, I will start a novel myself so that, I can read it for you and you read me your stories, and so we connect that way. So they said, so what are you going to write about? So I said, I'm going to write about a man whose main weakness is hero worship. This man identifies with Mandela to the extent that when Mandela is finally apprehended, he loses his sexual powers, and he was known to be a womanizer. But on the day that Mandela is apprehended, he goes completely impotent. And this lasts for 27 years until Mandela is So my students said, you know, we all talk about the architecture of writing, you know, when you're writing a novel. And it's sometimes these are just practical problems. So my students asked a very practical question, and they said, so what does this man do during the 27 years while Mandela is in jail? You can't just have him knocking about and not having, not solving his problem. So I had to invent a whole range of things that he has to do to fill in the time and also to make sure that it's believable, this passage of time, historical time, is a problem for writers. Yeah. But this bit is about the day Mandela is arrested returning from Durban. And I try to mix real history, what actually happened, with a few lies. Yeah. So I'll read both the history and the lies. Okay. I used to work for a Zulu newspaper when I started as a journalist called the Ilanga laseNatal. It used to be a good paper before it was bought by some people who later became opposed to the ANC or to the liberation struggle. I made a joke about Ilanga in the 1980s, you know, when it started going bad and it started telling lies. But it was called, in the novel, it's called Iqiniso. Iqiniso means the truth teller. So I'll read a little bit of it. It was Zondi, a distant cousin of Nobush, a bus driver with the Durban Tourist Company, who brought to Mondi news of Mandela's capture. The announcement in heavy black headlines was all over the front page of the Zulu newspaper. How, on returning from a clandestine visit to the freedom fighters of the Durban underground, Mandela and his chauffeur had been overtaken by a car full of special branch detectives. Two other cars drove up from the rear, cutting the fugitives off from any possibility of escape. The story was there on the front page of the soiled, the tattered newspaper, Iqiniso, which, although its name meant the truth, was infamous for telling lies, but which for once seemed to be telling the truth. For who could invent such an entrancing story that after weeks and months of trying to run down their quarry on a fine Sunday afternoon along a stretch of Durban-Johannesburg Highway, Mandela should drive his damaged little Opel straight into a police cordon? It wasn't an Opel, by the way. I mean, I had to invent that. Under his disguise of a chauffeur's white dust coat and cap, Iqiniso reported that under questioning, Mandela first gave his name as a certain David Motsemai. For the detectives, this was cause for some merriment. Ugh, you are not a detective, joked. You're most Nelson Mandela. Unshaven, hair disheveled, their eyes tired and bloodshot, heavy-lidded from hours of sleepless vigil in a car parked under a clump of trees by the roadside. I don't think they were parked under the trees, but I had to invent it. They had taken hourly turns to watch the road for approaching cars, one of which, according to a well-placed police informer, would be carrying Mandela on his return journey to his Johannesburg hideout. A small posse of highly trained, highly disciplined, not to mention highly motivated men in three cars, each car containing three or four men, which brought the total to 15 heavily armed, specially trained security officers. The officers could scarcely conceal their excitement, their complete satisfaction at the triumphant conclusion of their mission. Victory made them more affable than usual. In such circumstances, a little display of humor seemed hardly out of place. One officer leaned into the window of the car. "Your name, please?" "David Motsemai." "Oh, man, we know who you are. You are Nelson Mandela." A little banter in the voice, casual, self-satisfied. Then turning to the man in the driver's seat, "And this is Cecil Williams. We are both under arrest." During the vigil, the strain of waiting had been intolerable. To kill time, the officers had chain-smoked, drinking black coffee laced with brandy from paper cups, and had told many stale, dirty jokes. At night, opening the door of one of the cars, an officer thought he saw a snake rustling past in the trampled, dew-decked grass. Not a big snake, but slim, so slim that it could hardly pass off as Mandela disguised as a reptile, perhaps attempting to slide past a police car. Of course, should Mandela stage another of his narrow escapes, the natives would gladly seize upon such an explanation. There were already many such stories going the rounds, how once sighted Mandela was able to transform himself at will into a black bull grazing nonchalantly in the countryside. During the waiting, one policeman, a tall man about 50, with a high forehead and receding hairline, was so much on edge that his stomach rumbled incessantly. From time to time, he tried without success to suppress a fart, and a noisome odor filled the car, in which talk temporarily seemed to stop while the driver at the front pulled down the window. The officer's anxiety was met only by that of a younger man they called Johannes, who seemed in the grip of an eternal agitation. Johannes brooded darkly, smoked endless cigarettes, and when they offered him a snifter of brandy to calm his nerves, he pointedly refused it, pushing it away with a meaningful gesture of prim disapproval at the lapse of discipline among his superiors. If he shoots, Johannes kept repeating, "We will take him on. We shouldn't mess around with him." "No shooting," Colonel Katzenberger said. He turned to look to all the men around him, one by one. "Understand? No shooting. At headquarters, they want him taken alive. After all, we can't question a dead man." "What if he's armed?" the young man protested. He disliked the colonel's lofty tone of worldly sophistication. Captain Monstead, who played rugby for Natal Police 15, let it be known that if Mandela attempted to pass, he would tackle him to the ground without much trouble. "I know he used to be a boxer, but that was a long time ago when he was a strappy young cock. He may think he's still fit, but I'm a damn lot fitter than he is, I promise you. Ask Van Zyl here." Young Klep Van Zyl was enamored of the hunt for its own sake. He had little illusion about the state being able to withstand the final onslaught by the hordes of armed natives trying to overrun a lager of badly outnumbered white men on the African continent. Addressing no one in particular, he rambled on, "Doubtless, the future of this continent belongs to the natives. Anyone with an iota of sense can see that clear as daylight. But that doesn't mean we will sit here and wait for the natives to take everything without a big fight. What I'm saying is, this is not yet Mandela's time. We must make the natives pay dearly in pain for whatever they take. They must win every battle, every inch of territory by force of arms. And I can tell you, I'm looking forward to all the battles which are yet to come. Meanwhile, while we're in control, let every white man, woman, and child extract the best advantage they can before we go under. In short, let's have a party."
Did you ever feel the urge of writing in your mother or father language?
Oh, I've done it. Yeah. I have a nice story that will amuse some of you. We recently, no, not so recent, but in the late 1980s, we were, a friend of mine, Stanley Glasser, the composer, one of those clever Jewish boys who went to Cambridge and collected straight A's from in the music department of Cambridge. So he became a good composer, and he's now the head of the music department at Goldsmith College. But Stanley used to go to Zululand as a young boy. He speaks Zulu very well, and he used to go to Zululand to spend his vacation from school with the servant who worked for the family. And when the servant went back to spend time in the rural district of Zululand, he would take little Stanley with him. So when the King Singers, or I don't know whether some of you know about the King Singers, and they sing, you know, mostly medieval songs, and they're very, and Baba Shop songs, very good. So for their 10th anniversary of being together, they'd gone to school with Stanley in Cambridge. So they asked Stanley if he could write something for them, a cycle of about 6 songs. And they were going to sing these songs in Zulu. Yeah. And boy, that was a lot of work. I mean, first of all, Stanley asked me if I would consider writing this Cyclops of Zulu song. So I agreed, because this was a great opportunity for me. But then that was only the start. It was all very well for him to compose notations, I mean, for melodies and so on. But we had to get this Englishman who didn't speak a word of Zulu to start singing in Zulu. So we had these sessions in which we had to teach them how to pronounce the Zulu words. And they recorded a whole album of those songs, and they're still being played around the world. But what I'm trying to answer is the question you put, whether I've considered writing things in my own language. And I did some of those things. And Stanley and I also wrote a long choral thing in Zulu, which the London Symphony Orchestra recorded for the BBC. And that was the story, you must know it, that it's an old African legend, the chameleon and the lizard, and that God made up his mind that man must not die, or men and women must not die, and sent chameleon to tell human beings that they are not going to die. And chameleon got sidetracked by berries, you know, and started eating all this stuff and took his time. And then meanwhile God changed his mind and said, okay, I've changed my mind. Sent lizard. Lizard goes like this and go and tell man that I've changed my mind and man must die. And when I was growing up, the Zulus always killed a lizard because they considered it that the lizard was responsible for that. But this was a long piece of work with probably about 90 odd lines that Stanley and I wrote for the London Symphony Orchestra. So I'm not foreign to working in my own language, but I have to say that I find it these days much easier to think in English and to dream in English. And the odd thing about that is that my grandmother, to whom I dedicated my novel, she didn't speak English. Or not much, except, you know, just carrying out orders from her white employers. But these days, when I when I'm dreaming about her, because I dream about her, look, she's always talking to me in English.
In English?
And I find it most extraordinary. Because I don't know how she can express herself so vividly in English. I mean. So it tells you a lot about the unconscious and the mind of writers and how you filter things through your own consciousness and then attribute these things to the people you write about, so that you have people who never could have spoken Russian. If you're Russian, if you write in Russian, you have your grandmother speaking Russian to you.